Historian and biographer Richard Norton Smith is in our region talking about his new book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. 14 years in the writing, the book is being hailed as the definitive biography of the New York governor and U.S. vice president. Historian Douglas Brinkley described the book as one of the greatest cradle-to-grave biographies written in the past 50 years. There will be a conversation with Richard Norton Smith at 4:15 this afternoon in the Standish Room in the Science Library at SUNY Albany. And Smith will be speaking tonight at 7:30 about his biography at Page Hall on SUNY's downtown campus at 8 o'clock. Again, the title of the book is On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. It's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Norton Smith to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Oh, hey, thank you. It's always nice to be back in Albany.
I love having you here because I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I knew, sort of the Cliff Notes version of Nelson Rockefeller, and had done some research. And I think what you point out within this book is there hasn't been a whole lot written about the guy.
No, actually, tragically, I mean, there was a very, very fine book by Kerry Reich published back in the 90s that took the story up to his election as governor.
Right.
And then, tragically, Kerry passed away before he could write a second volume. That's sort of the one significant book that has appeared that's drawn on the papers. What I was able to do was to take advantage, frankly, of thousands of pages of the Rockefeller archives that have since been opened. But also, you know, Nelson, when he came back from the vice presidency, was in hock to his trust for $10 million. So he decided he would make some cash and had to think of Rockefeller being cash poor. But anyway, he would write a memoir. Well, the book never got written, but he did over 500 pages of oral history. And it turns out to be gold. And that was one of the news sources. They opened, I actually tore up my first 70,000 words that I'd written several years into the project when the archives opened 125 boxes of paper marked family and friends. And it contained, among other things, for example, the courtship correspondence between Nelson and his first wife. Well, you know, it just changed everything we thought we knew. And there was instance after instance. And that's one reason, frankly, it took 14 years.
When it comes to his life, it I guess it's easiest to, and I even sort of said this in the introduction, although not blatantly, but there are these very definitive periods of his life. There are stages, and they're fascinating because they're linear in some way, but they do seem to be very okay. You start off, you're working with your father, you're helping to establish the Museum of Modern Art, you're governor of New York State, you're vice president of the United States. I mean, there are huge swaths,
and that's a great point because going into this, they didn't necessarily all seem to fit together. Nelson himself said of his experience at Dartmouth that it was very scattershot. I mean, he was a term not often applied to him. He's a Renaissance man. I mean, he might have had a better chance to become president if he'd been like Richard Nixon, and you know, whose first thought on getting out of bed every morning of his life was, what can I do to become president today? Rockefeller, one of the surprising things I discovered was art meant more to Rockefeller than politics. He wasn't a politician who collected art. He was a frustrated artist. And politics gratified his need for control and for creativity. So when you see the South Mall, whatever you think of it as architecture, in many ways it is a reflection of Nelson Rockefeller's desire as a teacher to share abstract expressionist art, not only in the galleries, but the buildings. The buildings are expressions of that. It's not Rockefeller Center North, it's Kaiket North. It's the Rockefeller Estate North with many of the same artists. There's a wonderful story Mark Hatfield, the governor of Oregon,
yes,
told me. And he came and he saw Nelson's apartment on Fifth Avenue, 34-room triplex. The Matisse decorated the fireplace. I mean, it gives you an idea of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And he was just blown away by what he saw. And he said, Nelson, I have to ask you, of all your collections, which one gives you the most pleasure? And Rockefeller said, oh, Mark, that's easy. It's my china. He says, sometimes I get up in the middle of the night just to set the table. Well, you know, the very rich are different from you and me, but he wanted to share that with the general public.
The fact that he had worked for so many different administrations, whether it was FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, Ford, he had his hand in a lot of different political institutions, which I assume was really what crafted him as a politician.
Yeah, you know, it's a great point because today, my God, can you imagine going into a Republican or Democratic primary, for that matter, boasting about the fact that early in your career you had worked for presidents of the opposite party?
Right.
Wouldn't happen. FDR was, by the way, the first Democratic president who told 32-year-old Nelson Rockefeller, who he put in charge of Latin America, that you could become president if you become a Democrat. Harry Truman echoed the advice. Those people who think that Nelson would have been potentially a great president point to the incredible richness of experience that he had working under presidents of both parties, doing different things. I mean, he was, Dwight Eisenhower was Henry Kissinger. He came up with the open skies proposal at the Geneva Conference in 1955. He was the implementer of Point Four, the foreign aid program under Harry Truman. And one of the really, the downside of all that, there are people who couldn't understand the on again, off again approach to the presidency.
Right.
You know, he didn't run in 60. He wasn't going to run in 68. Then he did run. And it flies absolutely in the face of everything we think we know about Nelson Rockefeller. But I believe it. Someone close to him explained he wasn't running against Kennedy or Johnson or Nixon. He was running against the ghost of FDR.
Yeah,
he had learned at the feet of the master that was what a president was. And believe it or not, he harbored self-doubt enough about whether he could measure up to that kind of presidency.
And what makes that so interesting, and I think you paint this picture beautifully in the book, is that the backgrounds of these two families. I mean, you look at the Roosevelts and the Rockefellers. I mean, that's there aren't many people that you can have that level of conversation of, oh, I know what it's like to do what you're doing.
When he was about 7 years old, Theodore Roosevelt, the scourge of Standard Oil, his grandfather's monopoly, came to visit the family. And Nelson, being Nelson, unselfconscious, you know, climbs up into Teddy's lap. And with a question, he wants to know, T.F.'s just come back from an African safari. And Nelson, ever the skeptic, wants to know how he managed to get the giraffes through the Hudson Tunnel. Which he said, an average 7-year-old would not ask that question. And T.R., who was absolutely charmed by this sort of junior version of himself, explained very seriously that there was this series of levers and pulleys and so on and so on. 30 years later, he, of course, was working for a different Roosevelt. But if you tell me what unites T.R. and FDR, actually, and Nelson Rockefeller. Nelson Rockefeller said, I feel that if you don't have good health or a good education, then society has let you down. Now, not many politicians would say that today. The notion that there is such a thing as society, that we have, in addition to our individual identities, we have a collective identity, we have a collective conscience, we have obligations, if we're successful, to those at the bottom rung of the ladder. The point being, TR and FDR could be seen as conservatives in a way.
Right.
They had benefited from the capitalist system, but they were shrewd enough to understand that it also bred inequities, and that it was the role of the conservative, the thoughtful conservative, the progressive conservative, to anticipate and address those inequities, to practice reform to avoid revolution. And Rockefeller said this as much in his later years in praising FDR. FDR remained in many ways his hero, his political father figure through his whole life.
Which is why you have Rockefeller as a four-term governor of the state of New York, and someone who is outstanding when it comes to urban policy, education, the environment, the programs that he set up, very Roosevelt-esque.
Yeah.
In the setting up of these programs that are so instrumental even today.
But he also bridged that era when the kind of the demographics, you know, the old New Deal coalition
right.
was beginning to break down. And remember, Richard Nixon, his old adversary, is elected in 68. And so the notion of Rockefeller moving to the right, for example, there's evidence of it. But Rockefeller was a pragmatist. Rockefeller was a problem solver. What more than anything else sets him apart from today's politicians is he absolutely believed and could communicate in a way that other people believed that there was no such thing as a problem that could not be solved. I mean, it's classic can-do. There's nothing ideological about it. And of course, in some cases, the solution created problems of its own. The drug laws are a classic example. To this day, along with Attica, probably the biggest stain on his historical reputation, are the Rockefeller drug laws.
Right.
What people overlook is there were two separate sets of Rockefeller drug laws that were therapeutic before he concluded that didn't work. He said to a friend, you know, I've wasted $1 billion fighting drugs. But rather than give up, rather than acknowledge that maybe this is a problem that he couldn't solve or that a state acting by itself couldn't solve, he came up with the third, much more punitive approach, which I think even at the time people thought was excessive, except guess what? 70% of the people of New York in the polls said they supported it. So, you know, Attica is also the other thing for which he is sort of held to account historically on the left. And I think you can criticize him for not going to the prison to at least demonstrate his concern. Whether or not he could have negotiated a peaceful solution is unknown and will never be known. But I think what people over the years have done is they've conflated his refusal to go, which at least is debatable, with the botched, terribly botched retaking of the prison the next day. And he's still paying a price.
Which arguably may not have happened had he gone.
Yeah, if he had gone, for example, it's hard to imagine, as observant as he was,
yes,
that he would not have seen there was this incredibly rising sense of anger, some of it racially stoked, on the part of the local community and the guards. Bad things were going to happen. And it was from the beginning, it was badly planned, badly executed. And then the state made it worse by rushing out inaccurate information about how, for example, many of the guards and the prisoners had died. I mean, it was mishandled all the way around. If he had been there, he would have, in effect, taken responsibility for the preparations. Who knows how the execution would have gone. I think he thought he could keep his distance from what was happening. But I also found a striking acknowledgement, going back to what I said earlier about not running. He said, whenever I found myself in a situation where I wasn't in control, that made me uncomfortable, and I was willing to step back until such time as I could be in control. Well, he wasn't in control at Attica. On the other hand, he wasn't willing to take control, in effect, by going to Attica. And as I say, the result is something that I think for a whole generation of New Yorkers and Americans have held against his memory.
Mm. Again, going back to an original point, that there are so many facets to this, and you could, and people have written entire books on just one aspect of this. So bringing the United Nations to New York. He was instrumental in bringing the United Nations.
And not only bringing the United Nations, here's a remarkable thing that I didn't appreciate. When he, at the organizing meeting of the United Nations, he and his Latin American allies teamed up to rewrite the UN Charter. And they put in something called Article 51. Why does that matter? Because originally, the United Nations was to have been run, in effect, through the Security Council. And there was no room in the world for regional alliances, military or otherwise. Article 51 authorized the creation of regional defensive military alliances. That means NATO. Yeah. In other words, Nelson Rockefeller really is the father of NATO. And think how the history of the Cold War would have been different if NATO had not existed.
And then, Richard, there is the personal life.
Sure.
Oi. So,
but it tells us a lot about journalism in those days, too. The late, great Hal Bruno told me he was on Jack Kennedy's bus in Wisconsin in the 1960 primary. And everyone was aware of the fact that Kennedy had a vigorous extramarital life. And nobody would have ever thought to write about it. In fact, he said, and these were reporters who were friendly to Kennedy. They came up with the slogan for the campaign was, "Let's shack with Jack." Now, Nelson benefited from that as well. It was Nelson's fate, however, to be still in office, still visible, as the rules began to change. And then, of course, the night he died, I would argue the real historical significance, and it is real, about what happened that night and the cover-up that unraveled so quickly and with such embarrassment to many, that's the night that American journalism rewrote the rules about what is public and what is private. I would argue it didn't begin with Gary Hart. Gary Hart, in many ways, suffered from what had happened several years before.
As Matt Bias' new book indicates, right. So that night, and what you're referring to, is that he dies of cardiac arrest during sex.
Yeah, with a woman who was not his wife, a much younger woman who had been on the staff for a couple of years. For whatever it's worth, there's actually context to this. And I discovered something that he had kept secret from all but a handful. First of all, he was dying. His health had seriously deteriorated. Mm-hmm. He had a heart condition. He said 2 nights before he died to a member of the family, he wasn't afraid to die, but he was sorry to leave everyone. He knew he was dying. He died in the house where three of his siblings were born, where his parents had begun their marriage. I talked to Mrs. Rockefeller, to Happy, about that evening and many other things. And she was convinced that he didn't want to die in front of the boys.
Mm.
And then he wanted to have his mother's death. His mother, had, to whom he was incredibly close, and shaped his outgoing personality. Today, she'd be the candidate. His mother had a wonderful weekend with the family, came back, and Monday morning woke up, had a massive heart attack, and instantly died.
Right.
And one more reason to call this book on his own terms is because I believe, Nelson Rockefeller believed, that he could have death, along with everything else, on his own terms. Didn't work out that way.
Hmm. And it brings the idea of a book like this, of going to, as I said in the introduction, to quote Douglas Brinkley, of a cradle to grave biography, of looking at an entire life. This book weighs in at, what,
721 pages, but who's counting?
Yeah, but who's counting? The blood, sweat, and tears of the author knows exactly how many pages. But it is exhaustive in the sense that, but yet, this is a very, very full life.
The saddest single thing in the book is a month before he died, he told his nephew that he thought his life had been a failure because he never became president, which, among other things, suggests a scale of aspiration in this life. But no, it's an amazing life, an amazingly accomplished life. Had he only been governor of New York, he was governor of New York for 15 years, reinvented American federalism. He said the preservation of states' rights depends on the exercise of states' responsibilities. New York State in 1966 spent more money to fight water pollution than the federal government did in all 50 states.
How many four-term governors have we had in New York?
Four-term governors? Well, the only governor who served longer than Rockefeller of New York was George Clinton.
Okay.
Way back when.
All right.
And 15 years.
But again, there's that Roosevelt comparison.
Yeah. Well, that's true. You know, there was a whole generation of Americans for whom Franklin Roosevelt wasn't only the president, he was the presidency. And there's a generation of New Yorkers for whom Nelson Rockefeller, when the 2008 centenary occurred, I wrote a piece for the Times, and I thought there'd be some snarky, you know, responses. Can you imagine, on the internet?
Really?
And get instead, out. Instead, I was amazed. Most of them were from people who had been able to go to SUNY and get an education. Because Nelson Rockefeller created, really, the modern
state university system.
And because he believed that higher education, particularly in this culture, should be seen as a right and not a privilege.
Roosevelt Island, Empire Plaza, Battery Park, the architecture, the frustrated architect in him had quite an impact, too.
Well, certainly the city of Albany. And you could write a book. I mean,
which is still being debated.
Absolutely.
I think it's fascinating.
Understandably. And it's one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight is the real origins. Because there's a lot of legends and myths around there, some of which, I don't know if I can say this on the air, of Mayor Corning, who was certainly generous in awarding himself.
All right, we're live, so be a little careful. Go
exclusive
ahead.
Credit. was asked on his deathbed what his greatest accomplishment was. And he said, I had Nelson by the...
Right, okay.
Okay.
Short hair, as we'll say.
Well, yeah, exactly. Which tells you a lot about Mayor Corning. But who had the last laugh? Because Nelson Rockefeller had Albany.
Yeah.
He had permanently transformed this city. And I don't think he built it as a monument to himself. I really don't. I think he built it as a monument to what he thought New York State represented. It was the Empire State. And to him, it would always be the Empire State.
And again, an artistic statement.
Those buildings are themselves works of abstract expressionist art, minimalist, modernist, whatever you want to call it. Originally, where the State Library is and museum, great museum, he had planned a 336-foot arch. And in the base of the arch was going to be, the state has the original handwritten copies of the Emancipation Proclamation and Washington's farewell address. The arch went by the books, and we now have the library and the museum. Probably an improvement.
not bad at all. Richard Norton Smith's new biography of Nelson Rockefeller is On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. Richard will be speaking at 4:15 this afternoon in the Standish Room in the Science Library at SUNY Albany. And he will be speaking tonight, giving the keynote on his own terms at 7:30, talking about the biography and Nelson Rockefeller at Page Hall on SUNY Albany's downtown campus at 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock tonight, or you can catch the conversation at 4:15. At 7:30? 7:30, I am told. I apologize. 7:30 tonight. So forget what I just said and correct your devices that beep at certain times, then put in 7:30. 7:30 tonight, Page Hall, SUNY Albany's downtown campus. Richard Norton Smith, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book and having you here. What a great pleasure.
Oh, no, the pleasure's all mine, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, tonight, 7:30, 4:15 this afternoon at SUNY Uptown. 7:30 tonight, the downtown campus at Page Hall. Richard Norton Smith's book, On His Own Terms. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.